You are listening to the Brighton Book Club on Radio Reverb 97.2 FM, a monthly show about books and writing in Brighton and beyond. This month we are talking Spring Read with bookseller Elizabeth Perry. We talk to Carolyn Bain about the Brighton Book Festival, which is coming up in June, and we discuss this month's book club book, Dazzling, by Jigadilly Emelumadu. The book club is also available as a podcast, and you can see a list of everything we talked about over on our Instagram page at BTM Book Club and in the podcast show notes. I hope you enjoy this month's show. As the sun is starting to come out a bit and spring and summer even feels like it's kind of almost on the horizon, I thought I would bring back my friend, manager of Daunt Books, formerly City Books in Hove, Elizabeth Perry, to give us a rundown of all the best books that are coming out in the spring and the summer this year. Elizabeth has put together a list that looks so deliciously exciting, and I'm so glad and honoured to have her on to talk us through what we should get on our to-read piles and what books we should pre-order and what books are going to be hot this spring and summer. So Elizabeth, welcome back to the Brighton Book Club.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited about so many of these books. It feels like a particularly good year, especially for fiction.
So, shall we kick off? The first book on your list is Windmill Hill by Lucy Atkins.
Yes, I've done my list alphabetically, which is a very bookseller move because I'm realising the release dates are all over the place. But I will make a point of telling you when each book is out for the listeners. So the first one, Windmill Hill by Lucy Atkins, is out on the 25th of May. Lucy is the author of several novels. Most recent one was Magpie Lane. And Windmill Hill feels quite different to the previous. It's got an amazing cast of characters sort of centering around these two quite unusual older ladies and all their dogs, their sausage dogs, and they live together in a windmill. And it's funny, but it's also got this quite moving story of celebrity and power and making art and I guess revenge as well. It's fantastic. I really enjoyed it. It made me laugh much more than I expected. And I have a real soft spot for the characters. They've become very real to me. And I think seeing how other people who are reading the book early are reacting to it, that seems to be what's coming across to lots of us, is these two women are quite special. And the dogs are such an important part of the book as well. That's really good fun.
People seem to love dogs in books.
Yes, they really do. And these ones are great. They've got such personality. And the way Lucy describes the windmill and the kind of systems they have so the sausage dogs can get up and downstairs, and, you know, it's not an ideal building for dogs with tiny legs, and so the women have come up with an invention to get them through the structure, and just things like that. It's so enjoyable to read.
One thing that I always really strikes me about your recommendations is that these aren't necessarily books that fit really easily into genres. And is that something that you that is to do with your taste, or as a bookseller and as a reader?
That is a really good question. I think it might be to do with my taste. Possibly it's also a bit to do with interacting with customers. Is to be honest, I don't find many people read one genre. And often when you're asked for a recommendation by someone, there's a kind of caveat to it. So they like crime, but they also like sci-fi, or they want a novel with a happy ending, but they're also quite interested in a specific period of history. And it's not as straightforward to go genre by genre. And often I find I'm most excited by books that surprise me. And those are the books that don't follow conventions and kind of, they mix different genres together. So something that you expect to be realistic, and then there's a little bit of magical realism coming in, or a big emotional drama that's also something a bit sci-fi. I think it's quite an interesting way of looking at reality, really, mixing all these things together. Readers are complex and stories are complex, and I think books that borrow from the genres that are best going to tell the story are the ones that I get most excited about, for the most part. But then I also love a good romance, and I want all the tropes. I want, like, you know, I want to know what's happening next. I need to know if it's going to be a happy ending, what's going to happen when. So it's different things for different moods, really.
So let's move on to the next one, which is Munro Bergdorf's book.
Yes, so this one's already out. Monroe's book, Transitional, is part memoir, part manifesto. So the tagline on the cover is, in one way or another, we all transition, which when I read it, I sort of thought it was just a bit of marketing copy, which isn't a bad thing. But I mean, I'm sure you've seen the same sort of things. You see a tagline at the top of a press release and you're like, oh, okay, you know, that's kind of... that makes sense. And when I read the book, really the ideas about how versions of transitions happen to everybody and the ways in which they affect our lives and the ways particularly transitioning out of things that were traumatic, so moving. It was so wise and interesting and had layers to it that I really didn't expect. I think because when I read a book by someone I think of as a celebrity, I'm reading it because I'm interested in them as a person and I don't really mind what the writing's like. And this was such a wonderful reading experience anyway. Monroe is so impressive life-wise, but also her writing is so wonderful. Her perspective on trauma is so interesting. There's passages in there that sort of clarified things that I've been thinking about in a way I wouldn't have got to myself if I wasn't thinking about the idea of transitioning. So I'm really glad I read it and I really hope it finds a wider readership, because I do think sometimes books by celebs get bought by their fans. I don't know how true that is across the board, but I suppose it's more likely to be picked up by someone that recognizes the name. So I really hope this finds a wider readership, because I thought it was a very interesting and illuminating read.
It's very nice to see a celebrity book, in inverted commas, like exceeding expectations, because it's very easy to feel very cynical about it. I had a celebrity author interviewed recently on a podcast and they said it was amazing. The publisher you know, asked me to write the book and they hadn't even read my writing yet. And I was like,
oh. Yeah. It's not good, is it?
Good. Right. So moving on now to Patrick Bringley's book.
Yes, this is another memoir. And this is another memoir that's already out. So Patrick's book is about his time working as a museum guard in the Met in New York. And the book starts, I think he's doing a journalism job. He's not in that field at all. And his brother receives a fatal cancer diagnosis, and Patrick, there's a lovely line in the blurb that says Patrick seeks solace in the most beautiful place he knows, and he applies for this job as a guard at the Met and gets it, and then spends I think the next 10 years working there. And the book is about art and about people and about grief, and he's got such a beautiful, friendly voice. There's something very comforting about the book, and the way he writes about art is really accessible. I think sometimes I read a book about art and I feel a little bit locked out of what they're referencing. I still enjoy it, but I don't always feel welcome, if that makes sense. Whereas this is the thing, it feels like I've walked through the Met with Patrick. I think if the book is having gone through the gallery and having those quiet moments of looking around in awe and being allowed to react with your own feelings before someone tells you the interesting truth about the artifact you're looking at, that sort of thing. It's a really special book, really charming and moving, and it's been illustrated. So rather than having reproductions of the art, it's full of these very simple pencil illustrations of the works he's talking about. And that's really nice as well, because you can really bring your own imagination to the page in a way, and you get that feeling of, I don't know, it's just every now and then you stand in a gallery space and you're like, wow, it's really cool that I get to do this and see these things. And Patrick has captured that exactly in the book. It's really wonderful.
That sounds gorgeous. Okay, so I love this title, Fire Rush by Jacqueline Crooks.
Yes, so this one is also out now and I think has just made it onto the Women's Prize long list, which is very exciting. Yeah. It's a brilliant novel about a young woman growing up. Initially, she's in Norwood, I think, South London. And I had a big shock partway through. There's a big event really near the beginning of the book that in hindsight, rereading the blurb, I really should have seen coming, but I didn't. So I'm going to try not to say too much about the plot, but something happens that really changes her circumstances and she goes on quite a big journey. In it, there's lots about music, there's lots about dancing, there's lots about relationships, but there's also lots about race and lots about British politics. And there's an element of, it's not magical realism, but there's the thread through it, there's a sort of echoing relationship with the character's mother, who's not around anymore, that has an almost magical feel to the book. It's a really amazing piece of writing because it feels so alive, but it's also got quite a magical classic feel to it. I don't really know how to describe it. I was blown away by it because it's beautiful writing. It's also really pacey. I could not put it down. And yeah, without spoiling too much about the plot, there were bits that just made me gasp out loud. And it's really nice to have a novel that blends that literary big perspective on things, drawing in all these different themes, tackling lots of different things, really interesting experimental writing, but also just a really good plot.
Yeah. Absolutely. Well, talk about good plot. The next book on the list, Scorched Grace by Margot Doherty. Oh my gosh, I have had the pleasure of being sent this and I'm halfway through. And I mean, look, I was sold at none, but when you gave me like chain smoking, punk, guitar playing nun with a dark past, I'm so there. Sleuth. I love a sleuth.
Yes, me too. It's really good. I was excited by the premise anyway, but I think it's been quite a long time since I've discovered a new like sleuth character that really got under my skin the way that Sister Holiday does. So she's working as a music teacher in a Catholic school and has a past as like a kind of ex-punk rocker. And an arsonist is targeting the school and she gets involved with trying to find out what's going on. So it is funny, but it's also quite dark. It's not like comfy crime or cozy crime, or it's not a comforting read. It's funny and it's enjoyable and it's a good laugh, but it is also quite serious and at times quite upsetting. It's got the full emotional spectrum and real sense of the hard-boiled detective novel, but with a queer nun at the heart of it, which I liked so much. I think it brought so many of the best things about the genre out by giving you a perspective that you wouldn't have expected to see otherwise. Yeah, it was great. Absolutely. I really enjoyed it. And I think it's a series.
Yeah, I mean, it says on the cover, you know, book one in the Sister Holiday series. So I would have hoped so.
Yeah, of course.
Lovely. So let's move on to Books and Islands.
Yes. So this actually is another memoir. We've got a little block of memoirs here. This is a reissue. So this book was originally published in the early 2000s. And it's being published for the first time in the UK by Daunt Books Publishing. It's by Louise Erdrich, which I think some readers might recognise. She had a book on the Women's Prize long list last year called The Sentence. And this book is Books and Islands in Ojibwe Country. And it's very short and it's an account of her canoeing with her baby in tow and thinking about her ancestors and about literature and about why books matter to her. So it's sort of travel writing, it's sort of memoir, it's sort of, I don't know, literary criticism, a bit philosophical maybe. But there's a repeated refrain all the way through it where she just keeps saying, books, why? Like, why do they matter to me? Why do they matter to other people? And it was just beautiful. I think for book lovers in particular, it's a really moving celebration of stories, as well as being an incredible story. I mean, she's canoeing with a baby. I'd keep forgetting that the baby was there and then something happens. And It's just, it makes a very good, quite exciting travelogue, as well as being a really interesting book about storytelling and about histories and what stories and language means to people, why it's important.
It's wonderful. A gorgeous package as well. Like, it's, they've done it so nicely.
It's lovely, isn't it? I've got one in front of me as well. I think you have that, and it's just such a lovely cover.
Really nice gift book, actually, for a book lover. So moving on to Nona Fernandez's Voyager.
Yes, another memoir.
If you are in a memoir kind of mood.
I know, and I'm realising at the beginning I said there's loads of good fiction. There is loads of good fiction, and we are getting to it. But they're all in the second half of the alphabet, I think. Yes, Voyager is my favourite kind of book, meaning it's very short and it's fantastic. I love a short book. This is a memoir about, so Nona writes fiction as well, but this is about her relationship with her mother and about stars and about history and about memory. And there's, I think the subtitle is Constellations of Memory or something along those lines. So it's weaving together a lot of seemingly quite separate threads, but they really come together beautifully in the idea of ourselves being made up of the memories that we have and what happens when some of those memories change or we lose them, or what happens when we try to honour a memory in a particular way. In the book, she's asked to adopt a star that will memorialise somebody who died. And there's lots more in the book about that, and I'll leave it to Nona to explain. But just those little ideas that kind of all come together to be this incredibly moving piece of writing about what makes people people, and the relationship between her and her mother. And oh, it's just really beautiful and so distilled. It's short in the extreme. I think it's only 120 pages or something. And they're very short paragraphs, but every sentence is so full of ideas that I had to keep stopping reading it just to let it sink in. It's fantastic.
Oh, lovely. I love a short book too. It makes me feel much more accomplished when I read them. And the next book on this list I have also started to read, and it's not very short. And this is The Housekeepers by Alex Hay.
Yes. So this is out 6th of July. So summer really, but it was so much fun I'm including it. This is an Edwardian heist novel, I think is the best way of describing it. And it's a fantastic premise. It's, so the housekeeper of a house has been let go, and the lady of the house is about to hold this huge party. And so the ex-housekeeper gathers together a group of women to rob the place, basically, the night of the party. So it's got a bit of an Ocean's 8 feel. And all the different characters, all of them are connected to the kind of, I don't watch Downton, do they call it Downstairs? Like the downstairs world of the servants and the cleaners and the people that know your house intimately, but you don't think of as being there. And they use that to their advantage. And it's great. It's really gripping, very thrilling. The characters are really well-rounded, which is tricky in an ensemble cast, I think particularly in a book, because you do need to really connect with each character to feel the peril of them almost being caught, and that kind of thing. But it was really good fun. It's very pacey, really enjoyable. And I can see it working really well as a film. I think it has been optioned, which doesn't always mean anything will happen, but I think this one is likely to get the big screen treatment, and I think it would be really good. So now is the time to read it.
I agree. I saw it described on the press release as Ocean's 8 meets Sarah Walters. And I was like, I felt that was a really, really good comparison. Yellow Face is a book I have seen all over Instagram, all over Twitter by RF Kuang. Tell us about this book. I really want to read it.
Yes, it's brilliant. I really like this writer. Babel was the last novel from RF Kuang, and was this big sprawling epic fantasy. And when I found out the next one was going to be a kind of literary thriller, but about the publishing trade, I was really excited because I do like this kind of thing. I love a bit of fraud and forgery. And it was fantastic. I'm really interested to see, because so far everyone I know that's read it has a connection to the book trade because it's not out yet. It's out the 25th of May. And all of us know the industry from the inside. And I'm really intrigued to see what people on the outside of the industry make of it, because I think she does a really good job of bringing it to life on the page. All of the things that maybe publishing wish weren't quite so true. Or, you know, there's things in there that have been popping up in the news, bits about ghostwriters, bits about various controversies. And all of it is underpinning the plot, which is that a woman called June has watched her friend, the hugely successful author Athena Liu, die accidentally. And steals her manuscript and publishes it as herself. And there's lots of questions in it about the kind of own voices idea. June is white and Athena was Chinese, and the book is about a particular portion of Chinese history. So June is kind of having to defend why she's written it, but also she hasn't written it. So she keeps... it's kind of sickening. The more the lies spiral, it's such a good like forgery con story, which I love if you like that kind of thing. The way things spiral out of control is done so well, and all the different layers kind of chopping between June and Athena, and nobody in it is completely good, which is true. That's what life is like nobody's perfect. And the way your allegiances with each character, like everyone I expected to have more sympathy for, I then ended up having less sympathy for, and then more, and it was just brilliant. It really, really good. And I think particularly if you have worked in publishing, you have to read it.
I've given a decade of my life to this godforsaken industry, and I cannot wait to read it. I actually love my work, so that's I was kind of joking. Okay, so the next book on this list is one that I have got on pre-order. I have had the pleasure of interviewing this author, Caleb Azuma-Nelson, before, and genuinely it was a real career highlight for me. I thought Open Water was absolutely stunning, and I was really glad to see Brocklehurst Productions have picked up the rights to Small Worlds, and I really rate what they do as well. So tell us about Small Worlds.
Yeah, so this is out on the 11th of May. And Small Worlds is the story of Stephen over three summers, really. So quite a lot of time passes. And it's looking in particular at his relationship with his father and his brother, and his ongoing relationships with a couple of women that come in and out of the book, and his mother as well. So it's what I loved about it is... what Open Water did so well, I think, was look at romantic love and the feeling of falling in and out of it. And Small Worlds does that, but then it also does it with all the different family relationships and all the different friendships. And it's such a... I just think he's an amazing writer. I don't know how he does it, but the way the sentences are put together, there's something really magical about it. It's got this beautiful, say it's very similar, beautiful writing to Open Water, but with even more packed in terms of music and, you know, the idea of the small world you build for yourself with your family and with your friends. I have to say, I actually liked it even more than Open Water, which I wasn't expecting. But it just is completely enchanting and moving. And I am so excited to see what Caleb keeps writing, because I think he's got a special something.
Yeah, I think he's one of the most exciting new writers that we've got.
Yeah, absolutely.
Very lucky. Okay, Mrs. S, this steamy novel by Kay Patrick.
Oh, this is great. I was so excited to talk about this one. It's 8th of June, so summer, but get it on pre-order. You will want it on pre-order. It all takes place in the summer and everything is hot and sweaty and sticky. And it's about a woman that starts working at a boarding school who falls in love slash lust with the head teacher's wife, Mrs. S. And oh, it was just fantastic. When I was thinking about why I liked the book so much, I realized that when I read fiction, I don't really visualize an awful lot in my head. I'm not really I think I'm just seeing the words, which I didn't realize I was doing. But I'm not sure I'm so good at engaging all my senses and seeing images and feeling things. And this really did that for me. I think the way Kay Patrick, the author, the way they write about what it feels like to be sweaty or to be scratched by a rose thorn or to be uncomfortable somewhere, engaging every single sense, was so effective for me. It really feels like memories rather than a book that I've read. And that doesn't happen very often when I read fiction. So that was really special, but it was also just so much fun to read. It's tense and it's sexy and it's interesting and everything about it. I was desperate to finish it and then really sad that I'd finished it. It was that kind of feeling. I'm so excited for it to come out and find more readers because I do think it's something really special.
Amazing. I love a steamy summer read. So from steamy summer reads to a book called Ordinary Notes by Christina Sharp, but these notes are much more than ordinary.
Yes, they are. So this is out on the 4th of April. And I was really blown away by this book. This is nonfiction again, and there's a particular kind of nonfiction that I get very excited about that sort of plays with the form. The writers that I can think of that are doing things with it are like Sadia Hartman and Claudia Rankine and Leanne Shapton. Things like, I guess, kind of essay writing, but with other media in there, so pictures and the text appears on the page in places you don't expect and that sort of thing. And Ordinary Notes is like that. So the book itself is 248 notes about the Black experience and about violence and about so much. I think what Christina Sharp does so cleverly in this book is pulling in all these different threads. Again, I think that's what I really like in my nonfiction, pulling all these different avenues together in a way that makes it so clear how they're all linked. And it's a really powerful book, a really amazing reading experience. Like, it's so hard, obviously, like talking to you on camera. I want to show you the book because I've got it in front of me and none of the listeners are going to know.
Lovely package.
Yeah, it's so much about the physical experience of reading a book. I think that's what has really drawn me to this kind of writing, is it works because you have to engage with the page, and where you've only got one image on a page, that's such an impact. It reminds me of, there's a short story collection by Joy Williams called 99 Glimpses of God, and all of the stories are really, really short. Some of them are two sentences, and the title comes at the end. So sometimes it's almost like a punchline. The one that always comes to mind is, "We were not interested the way we thought we would be interested." And then the title is just "Museum," which you read at the end. And because of the way it appears on the page, you're engaging with it in a way that it's specific to that physical book. And Ordinary Notes does that. I thought the writing was fantastic. I feel like I've learned a lot from reading it. And just as an experience of reading a book, I thought it was fantastic.
Fabulous. Right. So we're on the last three now. So Death of a Bookseller by Alice Slater.
Yes. So another industry novel. I like that this is becoming a bit of a thing. This is out on the 27th of April. And again, is about people in the industry behaving quite badly. Mm-hmm. this time in bookselling. So Roach is very into true crime and has a pet snail called Bleep, and is a little bit of a loner and an outsider, and a new bookseller starts at her branch of a recognizable bookseller chain, I think, called Laura. And Laura wears tote bags and perfume, and she writes poetry and wears berets, and everyone loves her. And Roach sort of senses a darkness in Laura that she gets quite drawn towards, that Laura really rejects. And so the two of them kind of become obsessed with each other, both for very different reasons. And that ends in very dramatic, messy results. So again, it's a kind of Patricia Highsmith, Ripley kind of vibe. But there's lots in it about the ethics of true crime, which is something that really interests me. And I won't say too much because I think the way the story unfolds is really enjoyable to discover for yourself. But Roach and Laura both have very different perspectives on it. And I think the way that's interrogated is really thoughtfully, interestingly done, as well as it being just a great thriller. It was great. It was good fun.
Excellent. Great. So our penultimate book, this is one that I've had the pleasure of reading an early extract from because Wiz Wharton was shortlisted for a competition that I was one of the kind of pre-judges for. So Ghost Girl Banana is out on the 18th of May.
Yes. Oh, that's really cool. This novel is a rare example for me of one that has two timelines that I was desperate to find out what happened in both. Often when I read a book, and I think this is more about me than about the writing, but there's always one I connect with more and I get kind of impatient. Like when it's the other timeline, I'm flicking through the chapters like, I don't want to know what's happening here. What's going on in the other one? Mm-hmm. And that wasn't the case with Ghost Girl Banana. I was so invested in both strands. The plot of this one takes place in Hong Kong and in London. And one of the storylines is a young woman being exiled from Kowloon and sent to, I can't remember where she ends up, but she ends up in London. And then many years later, her daughter, who's still in London, I think in the 90s, has been told she's the beneficiary of a will of a very powerful person, very wealthy person back in Hong Kong, somehow connected to the mother that she didn't really know very much about. And so she decides to go back to Hong Kong to find out who this person is and why he wants to give her lots of money.
That's so exciting. And Wiz is a fabulous writer. So definitely one to watch out for. Finally on this list, we have got In Memoriam. Why can't I say this word? Memoriam by Alice Wynne.
Yes. Oh, this book's so good. This has just come out. And this is a war novel, which is not normally my cup of tea. I think possibly the British English literature syllabus at school kind of ruined First World War narratives for me. But this is about two boys who are at a very idyllic private school together when the war breaks out. Both end up enlisting. And against the backdrop of discovering the horrors of war, they realise they're in love with each other. And so it's partially a sort of huge sweeping historical epic, and it's also a love story about love in a time when it was forbidden and potentially dangerous, and the relationship between the two. You get so invested in these characters, and what Alice has done so well is in between each chapter is pages from their school's newspaper announcing the deaths of students. And so you get to each chapter and you're desperately scanning to check your favourite characters aren't there, and you're looking for the names, and there's more and more of them as the book goes on. And it brought that period of time to life for me in a way that I don't really think anything else has. It was a remarkable book.
Now, I don't know about you, but I think Elizabeth's recommendations are a blessing and a curse, because now my to-be-read pile is even bigger than it usually is. If you want to follow Elizabeth on Instagram, you can find her at ec.reads, and you can sign up to her newsletter, which is always full of great recommendations, at tinyletter.com/shelf-improvement. The Brighton Book Festival is back for its second year in June, and I'm delighted to be joined by Carolyn Bain, the founder of Refrori Books and the co-founder of Brighton Book Festival, to tell us all about it. Welcome back to the Brighton Book Club.
Hello, and thanks for having me again.
So you are back for a second year. This is really, really exciting.
I mean, I definitely think so. I'm more excited this year, I think, than I was last year.
Because you know it works. It was an absolute triumph last year. Oh. What have you got on offer this June?
Oh, man. Well, double what we had last year. So we are starting, last year the book festival ran from Friday to Sunday. This year we're starting on Tuesday, because why not? And we are starting with a supper club, which is one of my favourite things. So Afori Books has been running a supper club for about a year and a bit. And we just thought, why not bring it to the book festival? So we're not fully revealing all of our names at the moment. We're still waiting for a couple of confirmations, but we'll be running a supper club for 40 people. And, it will be a really beautiful, intimate meal with food from three different, I never know whether to call them cook authors, food authors. I'm going to go with food authors. So we have three different food authors who will also be with us at the supper club.
That's so exciting. Now, what names can you reveal to us who are going to be?
Oh, I'm just looking through my list and going, who can I say? So for Supper Club, we have Lerato.
Lovely.
Who is, I mean, her book is just stunning, just absolutely stunning. Just African cuisine, but with these beautiful stories, like, just woven in. And yeah, I'm just really excited about hearing her stories as we tuck into her food. That is just going to be really exciting. For the next big event, or I think one of our key events for me, I'm biased, is our Windrush celebration. And so on the Thursday evening, we'll be doing a Windrush celebration, which is a, I'm going to get this right, just keep getting it wrong, multimedia exhibition and talks and interviews. Just celebrating, because it will be 75 years of Windrush on the 22nd of June. And we want to celebrate that. We love a good party at the book festival. Anyone who came to our launch party last year knows we love to party and party hard. So we're going to be having a big celebration of Windrush with a cafe, lots of different Caribbean cuisine and a DJ, a full exhibition, a photographic and textile exhibition. And we are talking to some big names in the exhibition world who are going to lend us some stuff to put on display, which is really exciting. And then we're going to have a mixture of local grassroots, everyday people telling their stories, and some bigger names telling their stories. So trying to remember, we've got Charlie Brinkhurst Cuff. Roy McFarlane is our poet in residence, Aflo the poet. They'll be both be running our poetry cafe, which is a workshop in the day. It's a 4-hour event, and it's a workshop with younger people, really encouraging younger people to come out, working with Aflo and other poets that we've got for that. Tyrone Horton, Nee Parks, and the other woman whose name I forgot, it's not on the list. And they'll be running a workshop in the day, and then in the evening, Roy will be doing a full show. We've got Isabel Bain doing a mini album launch there and talking about poetry and how her songwriting links into poetry. And then we'll be inviting the poets that have been in the workshop and created new works to come up and share them. We also have Greg Stobbs, the illustrator. He'll be with us for our family festival. Joel Avellino, another illustrator with us for our family festival. Patrice Lawrence, Vanessa Taylor. Really excited that we've got Marvin Harrison from Dope Black Dads coming along, talking about his current book and his new book.
I mean, really, who isn't coming?
I know, it's a long list. It's such a long list, because there are just so many events, and we're just and.
So where will these events be taking place in the city?
So that is the most exciting thing, I think, is that the whole of the book festival, apart from Supper Club, will be taking place at the CCA Gallery. And in the, so the whole gallery and the Sally Bennis Theatre and Atrium area and the cafeteria. So everything will be in one space. And it's got a beautiful garden. And so on the sunny days, we'll be sitting out in the garden, and we'll actually doing one of our events will take place in the garden as well. So yeah, just really excited about the venue and just There's so much, honestly. There's just so much. We've got Donna Noble. We've got Ione Gamble. We've got Maxine Mi Fang Chung.
Oh, she's amazing. I've worked with her before.
Talia Hibbert, Mammy Blue, Ori Agbaje Williams. I mean, I could keep going. Yomi Shode, who I'm really excited about. Iggy London. Did I mention Iggy London? How exciting is that? Who's just new book Mandem has just come out. Stephen Buara. I've got the list now, so I can keep
I can tell. Oh, this is amazing. So, Caroline, how can people get tickets to the festival? I know Early Bird's on sale at the moment.
Early Bird is on sale now. And I would just say to people that one of the reasons we've moved to the CCA Gallery in Sally Bennis is because last year we sold out on 85% of our events, and I still have people coming in the shop moaning to me that they didn't get a ticket and that they missed out. So that's why we pushed, we put our early bird tickets even earlier this year. We decided just to go for it even before names had been confirmed, because we knew there were people who just want to come. And so you can get involved by just going onto Eventbrite and typing in Brighton Book Festival, or you can go on to brightonbookfestival.co.uk. We've got Nels Abbey, did I mention him? You can find tickets and more information about all of the events up there. There are lots of early bird tickets, and there's a whole weekend pass if you really want to go for it fully in. And on the website, we'll be revealing more and more as more and more authors confirm. Very exciting.
It is so exciting. Well, congratulations. And I, for one, am really looking forward to it. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Our book club book this month is Dazzling by Chikadili Emelimadu, which is out now with the headline imprint Wildfire Books. I'm delighted to be joined by Sussex-based Chikadili to tell us more about this spellbinding novel.
Hello. Hi. Thank you for having me.
Can you introduce us to Dazzling?
Dazzling is a story about two different girls who are growing up in 90s Nigeria at the cusp of the transition from military to civilian rule. It tells the story of Ozemena, who next in line to protect her village, her hometown, and surrounding other villages from any sort of like supernatural influences, all that sort of thing. But the Igbo, the Nigerian type of those things, and Treasure, whose father dies, leaving she and her mother in penury, the spirit, in order to bring him back if she does something in return for him. And it's how both girls deal with the consequences of legacies left to them by their lineages or by their fathers in this ever-changing world that they're in.
Do you remember, Chikadili, the moment when you decided that you wanted to write this book?
No. I think it just coalesced out of experiences I'd had growing up and, you know, life in general. I've been fortunate enough to live a while. I'm going to have a milestone birthday this year. I've lived on three different continents. And so I think it's just born out of my interests and my experience. And also the boarding school I went to, the first boarding school I went to, which had such an impact on me because it was the first time I was leaving home. I was 9 years old and I was in another state and I was without my parents and all the things that I knew and the things that were familiar. And so I think going away from my family that young sort of contributed to this lasting impression that the school had upon my psyche, and which led to me having the boarding school as the backdrop for Dazzling. In terms of the idea of secret societies are rife in African cultures. And with the leopard secret societies, there used to be this pre-colonial secret force, that kept law and order and punished wrongdoers, that sort of thing, but they punished them quite brutally. So it's akin to having heads on pikes. What they would do to the person is they would make sure that the punishment was meted out and was viewed by everyone. So they would leave the evidence of whoever it is being punished in a public place so that people would be afraid, that kind of thing. And it was also them who fought the British, the influence of the British, you know, the undue taxation, the fact that the what the what was the status quo and the way that the culture had been operating up until that point. The British were coming in and just changing things, and so they were the ones who were trying to bat back the Her Majesty's what do you call them? Court, what do you call them again? Like the government, the soldiers and whatnot who were sent by Her Majesty at the time. So they had a very vast influence, and they were very secretive, and because of that, they were feared. And so I thought of having a story in which, rather than having a man be the, or having men be the part of this secret force, it was a woman. And if she's not fighting something that can be seen by everybody, then she has to be fighting things that are on the unknown side of things, you know?
So yeah, absolutely, absolutely. There's Dazzling is really influenced by Nigerian folklore. Can you talk a little bit about this and why it was important to you to kind of get this into the novel?
Oh, because I'm Nigeria. it was important for me to get the Nigerian side of things into Dazzling because I am Nigerian, because I'm Igbo, and because there's not a lot of people. There are a lot of Nigerian writers, a lot of Nigerian writers, and there are a lot of writers, you know, any sort of prize will bear testament to the force that is Nigerian literature and Nigerian writers. But there was not enough of what I wanted to, what I had grown up with. You know, there was Things Fall Apart, yay. And Chinua Achebe has done such a great job with bringing Igboness to this, to the consciousness, to the world, global consciousness. But it's been a while since we had anything of that bent. We have influences here and there, but I wanted to talk about things that I grew up reading, things that I grew up listening to, things that I grew up seeing or hearing. You know, you go to there are no, I mean, it's sort of like in this country, there are spaces that are dedicated to children, right? Whereas where I grew up, children grew up alongside their peers and people who are older and very, very old. So everybody grows up together. And so you end up hearing things that are probably sometimes way advanced for your age, but you don't say anything because you're supposed to be learning this stuff and it takes you a while to figure it out. And so I wanted to talk about that world that in which everything was sort of blended. You know, it's not just about age. And we found out obviously like Finland is doing the same thing, aren't they, where they're having the preschool kids go into the same environment as the kids, the retired people who are in homes and whatnot. But it wasn't just the social part of it I wanted to explore. I wanted to also explore the beliefs that we had where, you know, life exists alongside afterlife. There is no demarcation, you know. So I was very interested in exploring my world and the world I grew up in with in that way. Sorry, those are my guinea pigs fighting.
Can you read us an extract, please, from Dazzling?
Yes, of course. So I'm going to read from chapter five, and this is where this is after the first encounter that Treasure, the girl whose dad has died and left them in penury. This is the day after she meets the spirit in the marketplace who wants something from her. The bag of ogili is in front of our door the next morning. Afraid is doing my whole body from my head down to my toes. My left eye is pulling itself, and I pluck hairs from my eyelashes to stop it because it's bad luck. I remember the spirit eating raw intestines, and saliva fills my mouth. The way I ran from him, leaving the ugly fruits behind, leaving everything. I ran and ran, oh, until my chest wanted to break open, and the air rushed into my mouth, tasting bitter. It don't matter, he has found me anyway. I pick up the bag of fruits and I throw it in the compound dustbin. I spend the day watching the children in our yard go to school and wishing me I could go as well. At night, I don't sleep well. Every sound wakes me. The mosquitoes sing in my ears, and when I slap them, I shut myself deaf. Mommy talks in her sleep, but she don't wake up. Small time after Daddy died, she started sleeping for many months. Sometimes it is long, 1, 2, 3, 4 weeks, and sometimes short. Her sleep has lasted 3 days this time. And even when she's awake, she'll be doing sleeping Mulanya, talking to people in the dream because her eyes will be open, but she will not be there. The noise my stomach makes keeps the rats away from where they are chewing chewing stick at the bottom of the door. Come morning, and there is a carton by our door. It's closed, sealed with sellotape. I can't smell any smell from the box. I don't touch it. I want to wake mommy, but when it has not reached for her to wake up, it's hard. Only Auntie Odrigo used to manage it, and even that used to take all her power. But anyway, me, I try because I'm feeling that whatever is happening is bigger than me, and I need my mommy. Mommy, mommy, wake up. She says daddy's name and turns, but don't open her eyes. I hear landlady talking. She sits in front of her house on a bench shouting at everybody. Her voice is loud, but also inside her throat, the way that masquerades speak, as if something is stuffed there and air is shifting through to get outside. Under the bench, her dog, Captain, bites his tail and flies are disturbing his ears. It takes me immediately to notice that the curtain is no longer by our back door. And two, Ifani, landlady's grandson, is walking away quickly. He has the box. Give me my thing, I shout, running after him. Ifani jumps the last few feet to landlady and sits next to her on the bench, holding the box. I'm breathing fast from chasing him. I don't even know why I'm going for something that me I don't even want, except that Ifani is a goat who takes all he wants all the time, and the rest of us in the compound are supposed to just close our mouths and let him misbehave anyhow. I greet landlady. She don't give me face. She shouts something across the compound to Omalicha, her daughter-in-law, that she hates because anything Omalicha touches turns to money, but she cannot born children for landlady's only son, Chooks. Ifani unpacks the carton as I watch. One loaf of Goodwill buttered bread, one tin of Bonvita, Nice biscuits, evaporated milk, and a packet of St. Louis sugar. The rest of the box holds mangoes, ripe and unripe. My life wants the carton box. I want it.
Thank you so much. So you talked about how you've lived in three different continents over your lifetime, but you have settled in Sussex. Why did you choose Sussex, and what is your experience of being a writer here like?
I didn't actually choose Sussex, you know, but I'm a great believer in, I don't want to say fate, because Igbo people don't really believe in fate. We believe in fate in as far as you get to have a say in what your fate is. So I suppose in that regard, yes. I moved here because at the time my husband wanted to move back here. He'd gone to the University of Sussex and he wanted to move back here from, we had been living in London, and then we moved to the States, and then he wanted to settle back here. But the reason I'm still here is because it's just, I mean, I suppose he took into consideration my own desires to one day, I didn't think it was going to be this early. I thought maybe when I was in my 40s or maybe 50s, to one day settle around Sussex, because I'd come to Brighton and I loved it. And I just loved the coastal vibe, not the touristy part of things, but just the part where people wake up in the morning, they don their wetsuits and they go for a swim. Now, I can't swim to save my life, but I enjoy the fact that people can do that, and that you can wake up in the morning and you can just walk down to the beach and have a little bit of a prayer or a meditation or whatever. And there's a way that when the sun rises and it hits the water, and I'm talking about beaches. Beaches are not my favorite thing, by the way. I much prefer a forest. But there's a way that when the sun hits the water, even when on days when there's no sun, when the waves are roiling and just boiling over, the magnificence of it, the magnitude of it, it's very impossible to be on the coast and not believe in some form or in some sort of supernatural deity or some force, or it's impossible. It's impossible. You can't be by the coast and not be moved. And the other thing I really like about East Sussex is the fact that on one side you have the sea. Yes, great. But then there's the downs. So all you need to do is turn left, for me, turn left, and suddenly you're in this wooded area and there's acres of countryside. And sometimes, you know, there's a way that the light hits it and the grass that has been mown, the fields that have been mown look a bit purple, and there are wildflowers and there's wildlife. There are lots of bunnies. Everybody has a dog or two. I saw a few pheasants. So I did a walk 2 weeks ago. I did a walk from New Haven to Lewes for absolutely no reason at all. And it took me about about 3 hours. It was about 7.2 miles. And I can do that. Mm. You know, it was a great deal of walking on the road, but I had on the sort of sock you can see me wearing now. I wear neon bright clothing. I had neon bright clothing on, and I was walking against traffic so that they would see me. But I can do that. That's the whole point. So East Sussex is such a place that, you know, We have great transportation system in East Sussex, so if you don't even want to walk, it's fine. But if you really want a place where you can just take a walk and you're suddenly not in the city anymore, it's a great place for it because it gives you all the modern amenities that you want, all the trappings of modern life, but at the same time you can lose yourself here. It's very, very easy. And so I much prefer a place like that to a place where I'm penned in like some sort of animal on all sides by tarmac and exhaust fumes and and it's not just the fact that it's the sea, they're also like little streams, and the people tend to live very, very long, because I can't tell you when I first moved here 3 years ago how many times I bumped into a grandma, a child, and a baby, only to realize that it wasn't the grandma, it was the great grandma. And it's happened to me so many times because the moms are still working, they are still in the workforce. So, the great grandmas are looking after the grandchildren and their great grandchildren. I just think it's brilliant, you know?
Well, thank you so much for joining us. And Dazzling is available now from all good bookshops. Thank you for listening. Next month's book club book is Brighton-based Jane Crittenden's Worlds Apart. Please do subscribe to the Brighton Book Club podcast wherever you get yours, and tell your friends to subscribe too. If you have any suggestions for the show or want to know about sponsorship, please email me at btmbookclub@gmail.com. We will see you next month.
I'm Christina. I'm a Brighton-based facilitator and programme designer, and I am running a project this year looking at our relationship with death, loss and grief, really diving into this topic because I think we're really bad at it, and I want to create a space to learn and explore together in community so that we can get better at having conversations about death and really kind of deepen our own relationship with it. So what I am doing is it's called a huddle with an organisation called Huddlecraft, and I will be creating a purposeful peer group for 6 months. We'll start in May and go through till October here in Brighton. And I'm going to be recruiting 12 curious mortals to join me on this journey. Each will have their own learning question, and that might be a different angle on this topic. So maybe it's about end of life care, maybe it's about people's own grief and a personal journey of working with their own grief or supporting others, or maybe it's a bit more existential and looking at climate grief and how we can use that in our activism. So really inviting a diversity of learning questions to explore, and then we'll design a curriculum together. There's no one facilitator. I'm not teaching, I'm kind of hosting the space, and we each bring and learn from each other. We pool our resources, our networks. It's a really cool way of learning. I'm really excited about hosting it, and I'm recruiting at the moment, so if this piques your interest, then you can get in touch with me at Huddlecraft, and the huddle is called Death Times Life, so Death X Life. There's a website there, you can download an info pack and express interest and book in a call with me, and we can explore whether it feels like a good fit for you and we can have a call. I'm also running a few taster events, so down on Brighton Beach on Saturday the 25th of March, I'm going to be hosting a singing around the fire. I'm calling it Singing to the Lovely Dead, and we're going to be sharing songs and stories across the threshold to people and the things that we've lost. So that'll be a great place to meet up in person and find out a little bit more as well. There's an Eventbrite, you can look that up, or you can contact me, Christina Watson. You can find me on LinkedIn and through Huddlecraft. I really hope you can join me.